Welcome to If You Love This Planet. I'm Dr. Helen Caldicott, and in this program we talk about the greatest medical and environmental threats to all life, such as nuclear weapons and nuclear power, global warming, ozone depletion, toxic pollution, deforestation, and many other social and political issues that relate to global well-being. So if you love this planet, keep listening.
Hi everybody, thanks for joining us on the show today. I'm Jasmine Williams. I usually produce the program, but I've jumped into the driver's seat just for the moment because our presenter, Dr. Helen Caldicott, is on a lecture tour of North America and Europe. We'll hear from her very shortly, but first, we're going to get an update on what's happening at the crippled Fukushima Daiichi nuclear power plant in Japan. We're speaking to Arnold Gundersen. He's an energy advisor with 39 years of nuclear power engineering experience. During his career, Arnold managed and coordinated projects at 70 nuclear power plants around the United States. He joins us now from Vermont. Arnold, thanks for joining us.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Now, there are reports today, it's morning here in Australia on the 29th of March, that Japan may have lost the race to save one of the reactors at the Fukushima plant. But can you just bring us up to speed a little bit about what's actually been happening there since the earthquake on March 11th, 2011?
Sure. It seems like the earthquake caused the plant to shut down automatically, and there's actually six reactors at that at the Fukushima Daiichi site, and they all shut down automatically, but that doesn't stop the heat from being generated inside a nuclear core, because after the uranium splits, there's still radioactive daughter products, and they give off a lot of heat. About 6% of the total power comes from them. So the unit shut down, and it had to be continuously cooled. Everything was going fine until the tidal wave hit, the tsunami, and it flooded the unit and wiped out the emergency diesels, which provide the electricity to the pumps that were cooling the nuclear reactor. Now, because right before it had been an earthquake that knocked out all site power, the plant had no power to run the pumps. And we call that station blackout. And what that means is that they have to get power back within about 8 hours. And they have batteries that last about 8 hours. The batteries ran out of electricity. The plant was black, and the pumps did not run. What happened next was the fuel overheated because of those radioactive daughter products. And when the nuclear fuel overheats, it attacks water and creates hydrogen gas. And the hydrogen gas is what you saw on the first Monday and Tuesday and Wednesday. Those explosions were caused because the water molecules were literally being ripped apart in the nuclear core, mm-hmm. and hydrogen gas was escaping and blowing up in the buildings. At that point, a meltdown was surely in progress. The fuel becomes very brittle, and all these little pieces of uranium fall out and lie on the bottom of the nuclear reactor in a big blob, and they get to 5,000 degrees. They are so radioactively hot that there's a blob at the bottom of these reactors of slag, basically, uranium slag at 5,000 degrees. So even though they were pumping water in, you can't get to the middle of that slag, and it begins to melt its way through the reactor.
So is that is that what they call the core melting through the vessel?
Yes, right. That's correct.
And that in effect is a meltdown at that moment. Is that right?
Yes. Now, the authorities are trying to put a more nuanced spin on that, but the nuclear core is the thing that holds the uranium. And the reactor is like a giant pot. And so last week, it was clear to me that the uranium was lying on the bottom of this giant pot and melting its way through the metal. It seems like today, at least the Guardian is quoting that in reactor 2, the metal has become completely melted through, and now that molten uranium has come out of the pot and into the very basement of the nuclear containment building.
Right.
So it's very serious.
So what indicates that that's actually occurring? I mean, if they can't get in there to really get a good look, what are the indications of a meltdown?
Well, the reactor water level and reactor pressure have dropped.
Right.
And that would indicate a hole. And also the containment temperature and pressure have increased. So that would indicate that the lump of hot uranium has left the reactor and is now in the containment. Now, the containment's been leaking for days. You may recall over the weekend, some workers were exposed to extraordinarily high radiation and actually burned their feet from radiation. And that's because the containment was not containing. It wasn't doing its job. And radioactive liquids were getting out. Well, this makes it worse because now there's essentially no barriers between this hot, molten blob of uranium and the outside of the building. The containment has stopped containing.
So you mentioned that it was now sort of resting in a basement area. Is that not some containment?
Yes. The building itself, though, we know to be leaking.
Yep.
So that radioactivity is getting out.
Okay.
Now, what happens is after it's melted through the 7 inches of steel on the nuclear reactor, the next thing it abuts is concrete. So there's just essentially standard industrial concrete underneath this reactor, probably maybe 2 meters, maybe a meter and a half of concrete under the reactor. And concrete has air trapped inside it. So now you've got hot, molten material laying up against the concrete, and it begins to pop like popcorn. It begins to, they call it ablating.
Really?
So the concrete will actually wind up getting eaten through as well.
And so it's a
race against time. Gradually, that molten blob will cool. And the question is, will it cool before it breaks through the concrete or afterward? Once it's through the concrete, it's in the water table and in the ocean. So it is very serious.
Arnold, if we can just step back for a moment. I mean, this image of this molten mass is quite powerful, but when the uranium fuel is inside the reactor, it's not in a sort of liquid blobby form, is it? Because a lot of people don't quite understand, you know, the very basic functions of a reactor. But isn't it encased in fuel rods, and what are they made of?
Yes, the uranium are in little pellets no bigger than the tip of your pinky. And they're stacked one on top of the other in a rod, and the rod is made of something called zirconium. And it's an alloy, so it's called zircalloy.
Mm-hmm.
And there are hundreds and thousands of those rods that hang like spaghetti inside a pot.
Mm-hmm.
And the pot is the nuclear reactor. So when everything's working fine, the zircalloy, the cladding on the fuel, is around 500, 550 degrees. And after the Fukushima accident, when there was no water to cool the zircalloy, it exceeded 2,200 degrees. And we know that because at 2,200 degrees is when hydrogen is created. And those explosions that happened on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday of 2 weeks ago,
Yeah. Could
not have occurred were it not for the fact that the fuel exceeded 2,200 degrees.
Uh-huh. Yep.
Now, once it gets to 2,200 and this reaction occurs, it gets very brittle. And we have experience with this in the States. We had Three Mile Island. And if your viewers went up, actually, I have a picture on our website. If you go up on Fairwinds' website, F-A-I-R-E-W-I-N-D-S,
yep.
There's a we have a picture up of the Three Mile Island core after the accident. And all these fuel tubes that had zircaloy are destroyed. It looks like a forest that a tornado went through. And once they're destroyed, then those little pellets fall to the bottom of the reactor.
Uh-huh.
We almost melted down Three Mile Island here in the States. The molten blob got about 3 inches through the concrete, through the steel, rather, I'm sorry, on the bottom of the nuclear reactor.
Yep.
But there were two differences. Three Mile Island was much less severe than Fukushima for two reasons. Three Mile Island only ran for about 3 months before its accident. So the fuel didn't have a lot of that decay heat. Fukushima ran for 4 years.
Mm-hmm.
So there's an enormous amount of decay heat. And the other thing is that Three Mile Island was cooled after about 10 hours, whereas Fukushima didn't get water into it for days.
No. And I wanted to ask you about that too. Why have efforts to cool the reactors at Fukushima been so futile? I mean, we've seen fire trucks, we've seen water being dropped from the air, apparently robots from the US were sent over. Why is it so difficult to cool the reactor?
In part because it was built to be so strong.
Mm-hmm.
And these pumps, after the explosion, the pumps were contaminated with dust and dirt. And if you put dust and dirt in a hairdryer and turned it on, it wouldn't work.
You know? Mm.
And the pumps were inundated by water. So, again, if you drop your hairdryer in the sink and turn it on, it's not going to work. So when they went to turn back the power, it was nice to get the power into these buildings. But then as they energized the pumps, each pump sequentially didn't work because the electricity, there was so much junk inside the motors that they wouldn't turn. So they had to find an alternative way, and there was no clean water on site. And it was a desperation move, but they decided to pump in seawater.
Yeah.
Now, anybody who's ever had a boat, like your person listeners, would appreciate that salt water and stainless steel really don't like each other. And if it's hot stainless steel, it's even worse. So the nuclear reactor is stainless and then iron, and it's hot, and now we're pouring salt water in, which actually causes the reactor to be more brittle.
Yeah.
There was no water. It had to be done. But in the process, everybody knew that we made that TEPCO made the meltdown more likely in the long run because they wanted to prevent the meltdown in the short run.
Yeah. Were you sort of watching all this and were you aware of other measures that they could have taken? Did they do everything that, you know, would have happened at a plant in the United States, for example, had this happened there?
I hate to second-guess people in an emergency, but I can tell you that the Japanese are incredibly skilled nuclear technicians, and they are as good as the technicians here in the United States. So I don't think it was because of poor training or because of poor qualifications. I think they were hit by a wave that was 18 meters high when the plant was only designed for a 10-meter wave. And at that point, all bets were off.
Okay, so we have the melted uranium pellets that have sunk through to the bottom of Reactor 2 at the Fukushima nuclear power plant right now. What happens now? How can that be cooled, that mass?
This is a very dangerous time. You know, every time you think it can't get any worse, it gets worse. Now you have a large mass of molten uranium at the bottom of the containment. There's probably some fuel inside the reactor that is still there, but now the reactor's dry because there's a hole in the bottom. That creates more hydrogen. You think the fuel can create more hydrogen, and you can explode the containment. And that gets to the point of being very similar to Chernobyl.
I see. Because does that mean that the radioactive elements are then just totally dispersed into the air?
Yes, you're right. Absolutely right.
Right, right.
This is a play that's not going to have a happy ending. We're really fighting over making the ending not as bad as it could be, but it's going to end poorly.
Lots of media, Arnold, have been very conscious to keep saying, you know, this is nothing like a Chernobyl-style accident. There are few similarities with Chernobyl. Is that accurate? Are there some similarities? And I mean, could they still be on the way, like you just suggested?
Well, in a lot of ways, it's worse than Chernobyl because Chernobyl only had one nuclear reactor core. And Fukushima has units 1, 2, and 3, plus what's in their fuel pools, which aren't being cooled either. So there's about 8 cores worth of uranium inside the Fukushima units. Now, the unit 4 was shut down. There was no uranium in the core, and the fuel had been moved over to the spent fuel pool, which is also way up on top of that building. And when the power went off, there was no way to cool it, and it boiled dry. Brookhaven National Labs here in the States has did a study that if the fuel pool catches fire at a nuclear power plant, 138,000 people will die. So it still is a potentially very serious problem.
Because the fuel pools have more radioactivity in them than the reactor cores themselves. Is that correct?
That's correct. Right. And the fuel pools are not inside a containment. They're sitting way up there in the air with the roof blown off.
Good Lord. So I wanted to ask you, at Fukushima, are the pools adjacent to the reactors? Are they on top? Are they sort of spread out all over the plant?
They're immediately adjacent to the top of the reactor.
So
those buildings with the top blown off, you should be able to look down and see a blue fuel pool there because that's where it was. And I've looked at every satellite and every high-resolution picture coming out of there, and I can't see any water. So there's a real risk of a fuel pool fire. And what that does is it makes the plutonium volatile. And I'm sure Helen could speak more about this than I can, but a very small particle of plutonium, a microgram, a millionth of a gram, if it lodges in your lung, can cause lung cancer.
Yes, well, I know. I've been reading reports that plutonium has been detected in the soil at the facility, but of course, authorities are rushing to, you know, quell any concerns about that. But I do know from listening to Helen Caldicott and people that she's interviewed that it's highly carcinogenic. And I guess people are going to be really worried about that. And reactor 3 is the reactor that contains fuel that is a combination of plutonium and uranium in the core. Is that right, Arnold?
Yes, that's right. But all the reactors have plutonium in them because when they start fresh, they start with uranium-235, and that's where the fissions occur.
Mm-hmm.
But then the other element in there is uranium-238, and that becomes plutonium. So over the 4 years, almost half of the power at the end of the reactor's life comes from plutonium being fissioned. So all the reactors have plutonium. Unit 3 has more because they were doing an experiment by actually adding in additional plutonium, but they all have plutonium in them.
As do the cooling pools, is that right, where the spent rods are placed after they've been used?
Yes, that's absolutely correct.
Okay.
So the reactor cores in 1, 2, 3, plus the fuel pools in 1, 2, 3, and 4 all have plutonium in them.
Are the cooling pools being cooled as the reactor cores, or do they just need to be kept covered with water?
They are trying desperately to make that happen.
I
am not convinced that it is, but what the TEPCO has done is they have the fire pumper trucks that were shooting water up onto the roof.
Yeah.
Well, they were hoping it would fill that fueling pool.
Oh, I see.
But the pool is enormous. I mean, the pool has, I'm going to give you U.S. numbers, I'm sorry, about 60,000 gallons of water in it.
Mm.
And those trucks only contain about 1,000 gallons of water. So, and it's boiling off, and there might be leaks.
Right.
So the net effect is that they need to do what they're doing, but I'm not convinced that it's enough.
No. Well, Arnold, what does this mean for the five other reactors, or particularly one through three? I mean, if Unit 2 has had this situation now, where the uranium has actually melted through the containment vessel, what can we expect? Will reactors 1 and 3 potentially go the same way?
The Unit 2 was a little more damaged than Unit 1 and 3.
Right.
Even though it looked better. It's the one that still has its roof on it.
Yep.
In fact, when it had an explosion, it had more internal damage, but the pressure was kept inside. So Unit 2 had a little more damage, but fundamentally, you're absolutely right. They're really, it is possible that 1 and 3 could go down the same path.
All right. Well, thanks very much for your insight about all that. We'll keep our eye on it, of course, and maybe when Dr. Caldicott's back in the country and back in the chair, we might have you on again, Arnold, for another talk about this.
Well, I would be honored to talk about it. I think my heart goes out to the workers. I mean, these people are incredibly brave individuals, and you know, really, some of them are sacrificing their lives so that the rest of their Japanese brethren can survive, and they are very brave and deserve to be honored.
Absolutely. And have you noticed amongst colleagues and former colleagues, perhaps, a different mood now since this has happened, or more reservations about the industry itself? What are people sort of feeling in the States?
The industry is telling Congress that it can't happen here, and which I absolutely disagree with. It's not about a tsunami. It's about a single point of vulnerability.
Mm.
And it could be here we have hurricanes that push a tidal wave toward the shore that could cause the same problem. Or inland on the Mississippi, we had 100-year floods that almost did the same thing to nuclear power plants. So we have there are individual things Mother Nature can throw at every one of these plants that could cause the same exact problem as Fukushima. And I don't think the United States has learned that lesson yet.
Well, let's hope that they might be open to some discussion about that in the coming months. Thanks very much, Arnold Gundersen, for talking to us today.
Thank you very much for having me.
Today on If You Love This Planet, we've just heard from Arnold Gundersen, who is an energy advisor with an organization called Fair Winds Associates Incorporated in Vermont, United States. Now, the website that Arnold mentioned during his interview is www.fairwinds.com. That's spelt FAIREWINDS, fairwinds.com, if you'd like more information. Now on the program, we're going to go to Boston on the east coast of the United States. Dr. Helen Caldicott is on the line. She's been touring around North America and is soon off to Europe as part of a lecture tour. So, Helen Caldicott, are you there?
Yes, I am, Jasmine Williams.
we just heard from Arnold Gundersen, who described what's happened in the last 24 hours at Reactor 2 at the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear power plant in Japan. So Arnold described how the uranium fuel within that reactor core has actually melted through the bottom of the containment vessel and is now resting on the concrete floor of the basement area of that reactor. So it's quite an image, that molten mass. Helen, what are they going to do now in terms of keeping that mass cooled? And can you cool a mass like that?
You know, I'm not a nuclear engineer. I don't know how they're going to keep it cool except by pouring more water onto it, but that could create a massive steam explosion. The other thing is that the molten mass, it's a sort of larval mass, if you will, like a volcano, reacts with the concrete and the zirconium that was around the fuel rods into which the uranium pellets were packed, and could produce a big, big hydrogen sort of bubble, and that could produce a hydrogen explosion, which would rupture the containment vessel, which at the moment I think is holding fast. If the containment vessel blows, a huge, huge amount of radiation will get out, and it will emulate Chernobyl. And depending on the way the wind blows, if it blows towards Tokyo and south towards Japan, that's going to be absolutely devastating. Or the wind could blow west to east, which it normally does, and blow this huge, devastating cloud over towards North America. And rain or snow will bring the radiation down to Earth, as it did at Chernobyl, and it will soon circle the whole of the northern hemisphere. So we're on the brink of a possible catastrophe, but no one can predict what will happen.
Well, I'm in Australia, in a small fishing village where you live too, Helen. What about the southern hemisphere? Can this plume travel to the southern hemisphere?
The two air masses, the northern and southern hemisphere, tend not to mix at the equator. So the radiation will circle the globe in the northern hemisphere, and there will be little mixing with the air of the southern hemisphere. However, obviously some of it is going to be rained into the ocean, and the ocean currents move throughout both hemispheres. So, you know, there will be, if this should happen, there will be exposure through the food chain in the ocean through the fish, because fish concentrate these internal emitters, plutonium, cesium, strontium, and many others, about 100 others, by orders of magnitude at each step of the food chain, as in algae, then little fish, in crustaceans, then little fish, then big fish, then humans. So it will pose health threats actually throughout the globe. And what people have to understand is that if you're exposed to radiation, which doesn't kill you in the first couple of weeks because it's so intense, but you inhale radioactive iodine or strontium-90 or eat cesium-137 in your food, it takes a long, long time to develop cancer, from any time from 2 to 60 years, and that's called the latent period of carcinogenesis, or the incubation time for cancer. When the cancer arises, it doesn't wear a little sign saying that you developed this bone cancer or leukemia from strontium-90 you ate in some fish 20 years ago. And that's kind of the ace up the sleeve of the nuclear industry. It's this long, cryptogenic, silent, latent period of incubation for cancer. Whereas if I sneezed on you within 2 days, you're going to be sneezing and having a cold. Mm-hmm. Or mm-hmm. Measles, mumps, chicken pox and rubella take 3 weeks to incubate. But this is a long, long time. And everyone has to understand that. Now, when Chernobyl exploded, it had only been operating for 3 months, one third of the infantry got out, and you know there's the equivalent amount of 1,000 Hiroshima-sized bombs, long-lived radiation in the reactor core. So who knows how much would get out and how massive the explosion would be? What one thing about Chernobyl was it had graphite moderating rods like carbon in a pencil. Lead pencil, and it burnt. And the tremendous heat from the burning of the graphite helped to lift the radioactive cloud right up into the stratosphere. This will not be burning, but there could be a massive explosion which would release a huge amount of radiation from that molten mass on the concrete floor. And the other thing to know is that, of course, if there is an explosion in reactor 2, there are three other reactors at great risk. 2 numbers five and six are not at such a risk, but the cooling pools are also at risk, as Arnold Gunston described. But it will mean probably that the workers trying to stabilise the situation will have to evacuate simply because the radiation doses will be so high, and then God only knows what would happen.
Mm-hmm.
I'm projecting into the future. I may be wrong, but I'm just painting some scenarios. And what people need to understand is everyone's talking about low-dose radiation, and that's not appropriate. If you inhale a microgram or a millionth of a gram of plutonium, and there are 250 kilos of plutonium in this reactor probably, that's enough to give you cancer. And the surrounding cells, the alpha particle emitted from the plutonium only travels a very short distance within the lung, and the surrounding cells get a whopping dose. Some will mutate to develop cancer years later. The rest of the lung gets nothing. Now, to call that low-dose radiation is a total misnomer, because the cells that are actually affected get a very high dose. And it's the same with strontium that deposits in bone and giving the surrounding cells a high dose. So you must understand the concept of internal emitters. And if you go to the webpage called nuclearfreeplanet.org, it's described there. And if you look at my book, Nuclear Power's Not the Answer, internal emitters are described there, and that's what is not being discussed by any so-called health expert in this area, either on television or radio or in the newspapers. So we're not being adequately educated.
No, that's right. I have not seen any footage on television or read any reports about that. At this point.
Well, it's imperative to understand.
Yeah.
Yes.
Well, we know that plutonium's been detected in soil at the facility. The government in Japan is saying it's not at levels that threaten human health, though.
That's ridiculous, because all plutonium threatens human health. You know, when they injected it into beagle dogs, there wasn't a dose low enough that didn't give all the dogs cancer. Not a millionth of a gram of plutonium, but a thousand millionths of a gram or a billionth of a gram, 10 to the minus 9 grams. Now, if it's in the soil, it tends not to bioconcentrate in the food chain. However, if the soil dries up and it's very hot and the wind blows the soil, then people can inhale it into their lungs. Also, I haven't read of any plutonium measurements in the air, and Arnie Gunderson talked about that. He said it's easy enough in a helicopter to take a sample of air and come down and measure it for plutonium, because plutonium emits only an alpha particle, not like other isotopes which emit gamma, which is like X-rays, and you can easily measure that.
Mm-hmm.
An alpha particle is composed of two protons and two neutrons, and you have to have a special method of determining alpha emitters. But that's relatively easily done. That hasn't been done. And I think what is now becoming very obvious is that TEPCO, the Tokyo Electric Power Company, really is operating in the dark, literally and figuratively.
Mm.
They've only just attached the electricity and got light in the control rooms, but certainly not on the pumps or anything else. So they are just almost as confused as everyone else.
Mm.
And what really I don't understand is that the International Atomic Energy Agency, with all its knowledge, and the Nuclear Regulatory Commission in America didn't send its specialists over to help these people at TEPCO try and work out what's happening and control the situation. So it's really been, you know, a muddling disaster, I think, from the beginning.
Mm. And, you know, as you and your colleagues have been saying, it's a global health issue. I just think that, you know, many, many journalists are intimidated by the science and the basic biology, because, you know, if you didn't do much biology at high school and haven't done any since, really, you know very, very little about what you were just describing.
Well, that's true, Jasmine, but it's relatively easy to understand it. And I, not that I want to sell my books per se, but I wrote that book, Nuclear Power's Not the Answer, as a sort of medical guide. Like, I had to read Grey's Anatomy to become a doctor and many other books. People must read that book to learn and understand how radiation affects cells and how internal emitters affect cells. It's quite clear to me now that most journalists have no or little understanding at all of what is happening, and also doctors who are talking and health specialists also don't understand. Mm-hmm. So the educational effort has been very poor.
Yeah.
We have been trying to educate people for a long time, but I think until there's such a disaster like this, people don't, they prefer not to think about it. They don't want to know, to their detriment.
Well, you know, just back to plutonium for a minute, we know that Reactor 3 has a fuel that is a combination of plutonium and uranium. And plutonium's highly carcinogenic, as you just explained. But what Arnold Gundersen reminded me and our listeners was that, in fact, all those reactors have plutonium within them because plutonium's created from the uranium fission process. Is that correct?
Absolutely. And uranium is an fission product. A fission product is when a uranium atom splits apart and 200 new elements are formed, all of which are parts or broken pieces of the uranium atom. Plutonium is formed when uranium-238 captures a neutron, so it's heavier and a bigger atom than uranium per se. Not a fission product, but in fact 250 kilograms of plutonium are formed in a reactor per year. Plutonium, you only need 2.5 kilos to make yourself a bomb, so any country with a reactor can make many bombs per year, atomic bombs. And plutonium has a half-life of 24,400 years, and you multiply half-life by 10 or 20 to get its total radiological life. So it lasts virtually forever in our terms and understanding. So we're dealing with something that is really diabolical, absolutely diabolical, and it's carcinogenic in very minute amounts.
Well, the IAEA, the International Atomic Energy Agency, have, you know, continued to call for calm. As a physician, what does this mean for the area around Fukushima?
Yeah, I think a large areas, as around Chernobyl, will be uninhabitable for the rest of time. People won't be able to live there anymore. And already I think that the Japanese government is saying things like that, and the Japanese Prime Minister. So, look, we're in the middle of an ongoing catastrophe. No one really understands it, but if you look at it clearly from a medical point of view, it's very, very alarming. And I have to say, you know, if there really is an explosion and this radiation is scattered around the northern hemisphere, I think it's going to cause millions of extra cancers. And we know what happened at Chernobyl. The New York Academy of Sciences, which the New York Times is not talking about, produced a report not long ago where 5,000 papers written in Russian were for the first time translated into English.
Mm-hmm.
And they found that up to nearly a million people have already died from Chernobyl, but it's an ongoing catastrophe. It never goes away because 40% of the landmass in Europe is still radioactive and will remain so for hundreds of years, meaning that, you know, much of the food grown in Europe will be radioactive for a long, long time. And if you eat radioactive food, of course, you're exposed to internal emitters that get into your bones and into your bloodstream and into your lung and the like, and can give you cancer years later. So taking the example of Chernobyl and applying that to this accident, it really is very, very alarming. And I think everyone needs to read that report from the New York Academy of Sciences, and it's called Chernobyl.
All right, Helen Caldicott, you're touring around at the moment giving lectures. You've been in Canada, you're now in America and off to Berlin and then London. What are people saying to you in Canada and America anyway. How are they feeling about what's happening in Japan? Are they really scared? Are they talking about the US's 104 nuclear reactors? What's the mood?
Well, I've been in New Mexico, which is a national sacrifice state, and as I landed in the Albuquerque airport, there are 2,100 or so hydrogen bombs buried underground just next to the airport. New Mexico is all about nuclear weapons. Los Alamos Labs is there, Sandia Labs, and they're all into making new nuclear weapons. So I talked a lot about that, but I did also talk about Fukushima and the people. It's hard to arouse Americans. They're kind of psychically numbed, but I am really at the end of my tether. I've been talking about this for 40 years, and now this disaster is happening. So I just tell them how I feel. I mean, I explain it all in medical terms, and then I just tell them how I feel. And I said it's totally appropriate to be emotional and totally appropriate to be angry, because the fight and flight mechanism when you're threatened helps you to, you know, jump a fence 6 feet high if you're chased by a bull, and it's appropriate to be angry and frightened and to do something about it. So I'm kind of trying to allow people or give people permission to feel their real emotions. And the response is quite extraordinary. People just stand up and clap and they cry. And I found that too in Canada. I've just been up there at the Darlington hearings, where they want to build four new nuclear power plants on an earthquake fault on Lake Ontario, very close to Toronto, which has 3 million people. And the nuclear power people talk absolute rot. It's euphemistic garbage that I can't understand, and neither can anyone else. It's the way, John Howard used to speak and Kevin Rudd, stuff you can't really understand. And I just spoke about the medical effects, and you know that every male in the Northern Hemisphere has a tiny load of plutonium in his testicle from the weapons testing days, and that really freaked them out. So when you get down to the sort of coal face, the bottom line, people do listen. They need to hear a doctor talking about what this means, because it's all medical.
Well, next week we'll get back in touch with you, and we'll have another update about what's happening at Fukushima, and look forward to you being back in Australia at the microphone in a couple of weeks, Helen.
Thank you, Jasmine Williams, my producer, for everything.
Bye-bye. You're listening to If You Love This Planet. I'm Jasmine Williams. I produced the show, but I've just jumped into the chair today because Dr. Helen Caldicott, as you just heard, is touring America at the moment, giving lectures. So she is in Boston, and she's just given us some more information about the situation at Fukushima nuclear power plant in Japan. I thought it was a good idea this week to find out a bit more about those radioactive isotopes that Dr. Caldicott was talking about and how they actually affect the human body, because as she mentioned, you know, it's a health issue, this situation that's happening at Fukushima, and we really don't seem to be hearing from enough health experts in the media. So this is an excerpt from a lecture that Helen Caldicott gave in the US in 2009. She was urging President Obama to end his support for nuclear power, and she was describing the medical and environmental consequences of nuclear power generation.
Now, the other very important thing about radiation is the egg and sperm, both of which contain half the number of chromosomes and genes. Every single gene in every single egg and sperm is precious. Now, we all carry several hundred genes for disease, like diabetes, cystic fibrosis, phenylketonuria, you name it, most of which are recessive. You have to have two blue-eyed genes to get blue eyes, because they're recessive. If you have a blue-eyed and brown-eyed gene, the brown-eyed gene dominates, you're going to have brown eyes. So my specialty is cystic fibrosis. One in 25 of us carry the gene, Caucasians. And so in this room, there would be a few carriers. The incidence is one per 1,600 live births, and it's fatal, and it's a tragic, tragic disease. The reason we have abnormal aberrant genes is radiation in the past. Radiation-induced mutations, some of which were advantageous, so fish developed lungs, birds developed wings, and we evolved this magnificent species of human beings with this huge neocortex and opposing thumb and stand on our hind limbs. I think we're an evolutionary aberrant, actually, because we're destroying the planet. But most mutations that occur through time and now are deleterious. They produce disease. And, you know, we've only been here a short time, like 1.5 million years. We're so young. So all mutations caused by the nuclear industry and chemicals and the like, almost all are deleterious. So over time, it takes 20 generations for a recessive mutation to express itself. So two of them get together and a kid's born with CF or diabetes. You'll see an increased incidence of genetic diseases for the rest of time, and there are now 25,000 genetic diseases described. Okay? This is all in my book, Nuclear Power's Not the Answer to Global Warming. So nuclear power's going to leave a legacy. The uranium is enriched and formed into ceramic pellets and put in zirconium fuel rods, which are half an inch thick and 12 feet long, like a curtain rod. You take it along to a reactor and you pack 100 tons of uranium in the reactor core. You submerge it in water, H2O, and there are moderating rods which moderate the flux of neutrons, and they're made of boron. And if you slowly lift the moderating rods out, because the uranium atoms are always shooting off neutrons naturally, it reaches what's called critical mass, which is what you get in a nuclear explosion, except it's controlled criticality, so it doesn't explode, but the heat, huge amounts of heat are produced because E equals mc squared. Energy equals the mass of atoms times the speed of light squared, and that's the energy that's released by splitting the atoms. It's primal energy. It's the energy inside the centre of the sun. And this energy is hot. It boils the water, the steam is taken off, which turns a turbine which generates electricity. So all a nuclear power plant is designed to do is to boil water. It's like cutting a pound of butter with a chainsaw. So what happens is 200 new elements are made, none of which existed before, all of which are intensely radioactive, and that's nuclear waste. Some last seconds and some last, for instance, I1 through 9, radioactive iodine lasts 17 million years. Okay? Now, every year, one-third of the fuel rods are removed, 30 tonnes, and put in big cooling pools. They call them euphemistically swimming pools beside the reactor. These could melt down. They contain 10 to 30 times more radiation, actually, than in the reactor itself. Anyway, each reactor uses 1 million gallons a minute of water. So they have to be located either on the coast, and as global warming occurs and the water sea levels rise, so the control rooms and mechanisms will be flooded and there'll be meltdowns all around the world, number one. There are 404 reactors in the world, 104 in America. And this water comes out after it's been used. It's a secondary coolant. It doesn't mix with the primary coolant, which is incredibly radioactive, but this water which is released is full of nasty gear. Isotopes. And a reactor can't operate without continually emitting radiation into the atmosphere and the water. What are they? What are the isotopes? Well, one of them is tritium, which is radioactive hydrogen, H3. And you had a lot of tritium being released at the Berkeley National Labs. And you've closed it down, and congratulations to you for that. But tritium is interesting. It gets through everything except gold. It'll escape through glass, plastic, stainless steel. And so an awful lot of tritium was released up there, and it's a potent carcinogen. In fact, tritium is absorbed directly through the skin. The skin lets nothing through. This is the most important organ of our body, the skin. But tritium gets through. It combines actually in the DNA molecule. It's very mutagenic, and it causes cancer of the brain and muscles and, well, anywhere it lands. It has a half-life of 12.3 years, so it's around, if you multiply half-life by 20, over 100 years. Now, every year, one-third of the fuel rods are removed, 30 tonnes, and put in big cooling pools by crane and remote control. If you stand next to one fuel rod, they're called spent, but they're radioactive as hell, the gamma radiation being given off, you've got a lethal dose in a few seconds. You won't die immediately. Your hair will fall out. You'll start bleeding, vomiting, diarrhea, and die of acute radiation illness within days. So they're, as we'd say in Australia, bloody hot, thermally, and if they're not continually cooled, they'll melt down themselves. If the cooling water's lost here, the whole thing melts into a molten mass like lava, and it disappears. And in Chernobyl, I couldn't find it for ages. It just melts into the earth. It's called the melt through to China syndrome. It melted too at Three Mile Island. There was a major meltdown. I write about that in the book. Oh, the other things that are released are krypton, xenon, and argon. Now, they're called noble gases because they don't combine chemically in the body. However, they're well absorbed from the lungs and they're very fat soluble. So they go to fatty areas like the abdominal fat pad and upper thighs. What's located there? Yeah, the gonads. And they're very high energy gamma emitters. So if you're living near a reactor, you could easily, if there's an inversion system, be you know, immersed in a cloud of noble gases. So let's get into... I'll just take four significant isotopes that are made in reactors, knowing that there are 200 or more. Okay, so radioactive iodine, you all know about that, don't you? I-131, it has a half-life of 8 days. It's around for 6 weeks. And what organ uses iodine? Thyroid. I've got a multinodular goiter, so does my brother. We were exposed to a hell of a fallout from British bombs or a British bomb when I moved to Adelaide. How do I know? Because they tested the thyroids of sheep, never looked at human beings. Now, chockers, chock-a-block full of radioactive iodine. This is a gamma emitter and a beta. Remember the electron? It only lasts, though, for, you know, 6 weeks. That's why when they powdered the milk at Hershey's, they knew it didn't contain this anymore. But what else got out? Strontium-90. It's a beta and a gamma. And it lasts for 28 years, so it's around for 600 years. It's a calcium analog like radium, so it goes to the bone, where it irradiates a small volume either of osteoblasts, which are bone-forming cells, and you can develop an osteogenic sarcoma like Teddy Kennedy's son had, and he had his leg amputated. They're pretty lethal. Or you can get leukemia because the blood cells are made in the bone marrow, so if an immature white blood cell, its regulatory gene mutates, later it becomes malignant, and the incubation time for leukemia is only 5 years. And we saw that in Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And your blood becomes full of immature white blood cells. You can't fight infection like AIDS patients who have damaged white blood cells. So you die of infection or massive hemorrhage. Cesium-137, which is all over Europe, big time. Half-life is 30 years, so it's around for 600. Like the sheep in England, it's a beta and a gamma, okay? And these all bioconcentrate by orders of magnitude in the food chain. Last but not least is plutonium, which is why uranium was fission in the first place in the University of Chicago. These universities, they are doing such evil. Okay, so plutonium is the only other thing that is fissionable, and that's what they make most of the bombs out of. Of the 30,000 or so bombs in the world today, hydrogen bombs, America and Russia own 97%. And they're threatening each other every second of every day with these weapons on hair trigger alert. They take half an hour to go from where to go, vice versa. The whole thing's over in an hour. I don't know how we're still here. Okay, plutonium is one of the most toxic mutagenic substances we know. It's only an alpha emitter. You can hold it in the palm of your hand. The alpha particle doesn't travel far enough through the dead layers of epithelium to damage living cells in the dermis. However, if you get it into your body, your lung, it's a potent mutagen. It either kills a cell or mutates it. Well, when they injected it into beagle dogs, there wasn't a dose low enough, 10 to the minus 9 grams actually, that didn't cause all the dogs to get cancer. That's how mutagenic and carcinogenic it is. Each reactor makes 500 pounds of it a year, and you need 10 pounds to make yourself a bomb the size of a grapefruit. So every country that gets a nuclear reactor gets a bomb factory. And we in Australia are selling uranium left, right and centre, and you're selling the reactors, cooling pools. They're becoming overfull and stuffed, too full from the original design. They don't know where to put it. And so one of the reasons they want to open Yucca Mountain is to get rid of the the waste so that and send it thousands of miles so that they can then store more waste. Plutonium is handled like iron by the body, so it combines with the iron transporting protein transferrin. So it's transferred, can be transferred to the mediastinal lymph nodes where it can cause Hodgkin's or lymphoma, to the liver where it causes liver cancer, primary, to the bones because the hemoglobin is made in the bones in the red blood cells, so it can cause leukemia or bone cancer. It has a predilection for testicles, and most males in the Northern Hemisphere have a tiny load of plutonium next to the spermatogonia, which are the precursors of the sperm from the weapons testing days, and that stuff's still falling out. Minute amounts, but testicular cancer is increasing in frequency. Interesting. And if a man's got plutonium in him, or I do, and I'm cremated, out the chimney goes smoke with the plutonium to get into you. And then if you're cremated, to you for the rest of time. Cremation is now contraindicated because it increases global warming. Don't ever be cremated. I'm going to be buried in a shroud like the Jews do. They tie your big toes together with string, wrap you in a sheet and put you in the ground while I'm nice and fresh and I can feed the worms. But, I mean, I just digress there. The other thing that plutonium does is the placenta lets nothing through. It's very, very protective of the fetus. But it lets plutonium through. So what it can do is, like thalidomide, you know, pregnant woman took for morning sickness, it can do what's happening to the babies in Iraq being born with gross deformities. Destroy the septum of the heart or the left brain or the right arm or whatever. That's called teratogenesis, damage of a genetically chromosomally normal fetus. Great stuff, plutonium. So here we've got a mechanism to induce in various isotopes, and I only used four, cancer epidemics for the rest of time and bombs. Well, I'll end by saying that the planet is a patient. It's terminally ill. It's in the intensive care unit, and we're all now physicians to a dying planet.
You're listening to If You Love This Planet with Dr. Helen Caldicott. You've just heard an excerpt from a lecture by Dr. Caldicott, given in America in 2009. I'm Jasmine Williams. I produced the program, but I've jumped behind the microphone today because Helen Caldicott is currently touring around Canada and America on a lecture tour. So we spoke to her earlier in the program today about the situation at the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear power plant in Japan. We also spoke to Arnold Gunderson today. He managed and coordinated projects at 70 nuclear power plants in the United States during his career, and he gave us an excellent rundown of what's actually occurred at the plant since the devastating earthquake and tsunami on March 11th, 2011, almost 3 weeks ago now. For further information about Fukushima and nuclear radiation, you can check out these two excellent websites, nuclearfreeplanet.org or helencaldicott.com. So I hope you've enjoyed the program. Thanks for joining us. We'll have another show for you at the same time next week, including a fresh update from Dr. Helen Caldicott. She'll be in Berlin at that time, but we'll find out the very latest information about the situation at Fukushima. So we'll talk to you then. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to If You Love This Planet with Dr. Helen Caldicott. This program is broadcast on community radio across the United States, including our host station, KPFT Pacifica, Houston, Texas. This program is produced and engineered by Jazz Williams, co-produced by Scott Powell, and our publicity and outreach are coordinated by Amanda Bellerby. To listen to previous shows or to make a donation, go to our website, ifyoulovethisplanet.org.